A matter of State versus Robert Andrews. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Justice Charles D. Adams, Robert Andrews, my colleague, I'm ready.
I'm Judge Jarrett, on behalf of the Public Defender, on behalf of the Office of the Public Defender, as front of court.
Good afternoon. My name is Alexander Shalom, here on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the American Civil Liberties Union, and the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey. I'd like to introduce Andrew Crocker, who's here in Prohibition.
Good afternoon. Christopher King, on behalf of the New Jersey.
Good afternoon. Matthew S. Adams of the law firm Fox Rothschild, LLP, appearing as a friend of the court on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Frank Jason, Federal Assistant Prosecutor, as the County of
the State. Good afternoon,
Greg Muller, First Assistant Prosecutor of Sussex County. I'm appearing as a friend of the court on behalf of the County Prosecutors Association of New Jersey.
Thank you, counsel, and welcome. Thank you, Mr. Shalom, for the letter. It was very helpful outlining how the argument will proceed on this side of the aisle, and we appreciate it. We will hear first from Mr. Sciarra.
Chief Justices, we're asking the court to overturn the appellate division and ultimately instruct that the order be denied for four reasons. And I would ask for the opportunity, sir, to have 3 minutes on rebuttal. One is that giving up cell phone quotes is testimonial and cannot be compelled pursuant to the Fifth Amendment. Two, New Jersey is a Fifth Amendment plus state. We have additional protections under our laws, and we believe that those also are impacted here and preclude the presentation of the compelling of the passcodes. Three, neither the foregone conclusion as it exists in the case law that preceded the appellate division decision in this case, or the modified relaxed version that they established in the case, are met regardless if, in fact, we do not prevail upon the court points one and two. And four, I don't believe that the remedy of contempt is workable as you move forward in these matters as proposed by the state and as compelled by the appellate division. I think that the case law is clear, and even the appellate division in our case indicates that there are testimonial aspects to being compelled to give over the passcode to your phone. The progress of this, I guess, comes from Doe and Fisher, and then Doe, and then Hubble, which talk very specifically about the contents of the brain and ultimately how the Fifth Amendment protects from assisting against your own prosecution. I will say that it is the Doe language used with regard to key to the lockbox versus combination to the safe, which is most troubling to those from the state. They suggest, page 26 of the brief, that it was a dissent from Judge Brennan, but in fact it was the ninth footnote of that case which indicated that the majority in that case adopted that language. And in fact, in the Commonwealth v. Davis, the Pennsylvania case that we sent to the court about 8 weeks ago that decided to overturn the lower case and raise this issue or dealt with this issue, the footnote from the dissent talks about that language and suggests that maybe it's time for the United States Supreme Court to revisit that and see if that's appropriate or not. At this juncture, I don't believe that any case law, any authority, points to the suggestion that the contents of one's mind can be compelled to be given to the state in furtherance of its prosecution. And the state suggests, well, the continuing viability of any distinction should be looked at because of technological issues, because cell phones are a new concept and a new technology. I would suggest to the court that we don't trash the Fifth Amendment because technology is moving forward. The First, Second, and Fourth Amendments have dealt with technological advances, and they still stand and exist for the issues that they particularly address and protect, the things that they protect. The trial court in this case relied on the Stahl case from Florida, which has been confronted in, to some degree from an equal case, from what I think is, as I understand, is an equal court in that matter. But at the very least, we get back to the very limited suggestion. I think there's a Massachusetts case that currently exists, and I'll get to that. Other than that, none of the dominoes are falling on behalf of the state. I think courts are meticulously looking at this and recognizing the Fifth Amendment does not allow, and really has it ever allowed, someone to be compelled to utter things from their mouth with regard to furthering the state's prosecution. And so when the state says that, quote, that the passcode is nothing more than a random sequence of numbers, I disagree. I believe it's a very specific sequence of numbers that someone, or letters with the numbers associated on the keypad, that someone has put there for that for their own protection and privacy, and it must be generated from someone's thought process, from the quote-unquote contents of their brain, and the Fifth Amendment alone protects it. My second point is that I believe New Jersey says we go further, and the rule of evidence and the statute point to language that says we go further, protecting our privacies. Now, in the brief, the state suggests that Boyd really has no application anymore because of its somewhat diminishment in some of the following federal case law. But this court very specifically said in Guarino that we affirm our belief in the Boyd Doctrine and hold that the New Jersey common law privilege against self-incrimination protects the individual's right to a private enclave where he may lead a private life. And thus, the fact is that the Guarino case affirms that we have these rights that exist up and above the Fifth Amendment. We learned in law school, the federal constitution creates the floor, and then the states are free to build a higher ceiling. And in New Jersey, we've done that. And I will say that this superior right of possession discussion, which first emanated in the appellate division decision, and we went back and checked, the state certainly is now onto it, but it wasn't even argued in the underlying briefs before the appellate division. On its face, I do not believe undercuts the state's heightened privacy rights. That statute says, in its opening paragraph, that statute says that he has a right to refuse or disclose in an action or to a police officer or other official. And then it proceeds to list in paragraph B, which was cited by the appellate division, unless a document, chattel, or other thing, if some other person or corporation or other association has superior right to it. I would argue to the court that the ex parte application and granting of a Fourth Amendment warrant by the probable cause standard does not create some right of possession in any way that suggests that those that additional state protection does not exist. The government's not an association, other people, a corporation. It's not listed anywhere in that statute. And so I think that is a whole cloth creation that needs to be confronted because there's, as we see it, no way, and there's language in the suggestion that the Fourth Amendment obtaining of the warrant somehow then trumps and eviscerates Fifth Amendment protections. Those two are dealt with and addressed independently. And so at this juncture, there's no case law that even remotely suggests, in fact, it's the opposite, that you abrogate a Fifth Amendment analysis because a Fourth Amendment probable cause standard was met on something else with regard to that. I'd also say to the court that were your honors to decide that we were going to get into this foregone conclusion, that it has...
Why don't we hold off a little?
Yes, sir.
And come back to your first point on the Fifth Amendment. What's the compelled communication here? Is the proper focus on the passcode or what will flow from it?
Both, because Hubble says it's not just the passcode, it's the loot that you get. It doesn't want to use the word passcode, it's the loot that you get at the end of getting that. And so it's not the utterance of whatever the word or the passcode is. It is the fact that that is the means by which you unlock all of these private matters in someone's private enclave.
So what about Doe 2, which says you can compel someone to authorize the disclosure by bank of records?
Again, very different situation. Those are third-party documents. That analysis was, as I understand it, and I become bleary-eyed reading this stuff, was related to a foreign company, foreign banks that were not under under United States jurisdiction. And they said, in that case, what you're doing is these are documents that have already been given or shared with a third party as part of some kind of regulation or regulatory scheme or something else, and that those items are not the same thing in relation to the contents of one's own brain, so to speak, in terms of that requirement, that in that particular case, what he was doing was complying in furtherance of a subpoena that could have been served on any domestic entity. And so I think those are very, very different findings or concepts that came up in that situation than what we have here.
I take it you subscribe to the to the metaphor in Hubbell that Justice Stevens had used in number two, that there's a difference between surrendering the key to a safe as opposed to being required to give the combination to a wall safe. And I take it that your analogy is that the passcode is the combination to the wall safe.
Directly on point, Justice Alvin, directly on point as it relates to the fact that, and again, as I understand it, I'll stand correct, that was Justice Brennan's dissent, which was footnoted by the...
I think it's Justice Stevens, I think.
I'm sorry, Justice Stevens' dissent, which was footnoted by the majority, right, that said, we're not suggesting you can do that. And that is what's hung the dissenting of court in the Pennsylvania Commonwealth case, Commonwealth v. Davis. The state points to that and says that's antiquated because of technology, but it still doesn't get to the fact that you have an issue where you're now compelling somebody to take the contents of their brains, their thoughts, their recollections, their memories, and then proceed
We need to address the Fifth Amendment, and the reason why I ask that question is in Guarino, all seven members of the court still subscribe to Boyd and basically rejected Fisher and Doe. They just divided on the application to records of a single-owned corporation. But none of the members of our court subscribed to the United States jurisprudence and then went back and discussed how our law against self-incrimination is much broader and protects privacy rights, not just testimonial. So why don't you run with that?
I would say the following.
That's called a softball.
That one's very big right in front of me, and I really hope I don't foul at all. I would suggest the following, that I think this is an opportunity for this court to affirm those basic principles loud and clearly. And I believe that...
Did you read Scalia's dissent in Hubbell?
He was not happy with the...
He was, but he seemed to be talking about the common law as it's expressed in our own jurisprudence. He was saying that Fisher and Doe, which were using this testimonial test, were probably off, and that if you go back to the early common law, it's, you know, like any evidence, any matter that might incriminate the defendant, none of that should be turned over, which seems to be more in line with Guarino and the development of our own common law. Go ahead.
I suffered the Socratic method in my first year, and I suffered here today, sir, only to say the following, that I think that this court can speak loudly to the Fifth Amendment, but clearly articulate that we are a Fifth Amendment plus state, whatever language, we have additional protections, the Boyd protections that Guarino clearly affirmed. And I think that that is what is before the court as it relates to that, because in part, we don't know what the future may hold with regard to the Supreme Court and any decisions they make. And if we base it only on a Fifth Amendment analysis, we may be back here again. But if we look at the very clear articulation of Guarino and the additional protections, then we get ourselves to a point where some states may have less, may just follow the minimum that the federal constitution provides, and some may produce more. But we have a situation where we clearly produce more by way of protections.
If these cell phones had facial recognition technology, would you be making this argument? If all that had to be done was passing that phone in the vicinity of an individual's face?
Justice Patterson, this goes to that biometrics argument, which is developed. That's not before us today.
I understand, but I want to understand the dimensions, because you're making the distinction between the key and the combination and the theory of the distinction based upon the federal case, in particular Justice Stevens, is that there's thinking that has to go on to articulate the combination of that safe.
But if you're the owner of a cell phone with facial recognition, you don't have to turn that on. If you're the owner of a cell phone, period, you have to have some form of access. So I think facial recognition is not an issue here.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll leave it to you folks. I will say that it has been beaten into my head that in terms of the biometrics and those issues, those are not before the court at this juncture. Yeah. And I will also say my own review of it is very different than the exemplars, the writing exemplars, the voice exemplars.
It's how is it any different from fingerprinting? What my point is that there is the technology. The argument you are presenting on the relevant issue, I understand there's no issue of facial recognition in this case, but the argument you are presenting is very specific to technology that depends on a passcode. And that if you were talking about something that operated by fingerprint, something that operated by facial recognition, the arguments you are making would not be relevant to those, it seems to me.
Well, I would suggest that the access to the phone, whether someone uses initially their passcode and then for memory purposes or convenience purposes, then puts on some kind of biometric feature, I believe ultimately that that's an argument to be had down the road. But I believe that's completely different than as it relates to compelled exemplars, compelled DNA, compelled buccal swabs, those types of things.
Why?
Because you're unlocking that private enclave, which is very different than forensics or anything else that the case law says. Justice Holmes, I read, said, you know, the body is not off limits in terms of the Fifth Amendment, but the what's in the brain is. That was in 1910, I believe.
If you tell somebody, give me, write the following thing that's copied from a note of someone who's a perpetrator, and you sit down and write it on this piece of paper, you're asking for a mental process. The person's handwriting is, I don't know where handwriting comes from in the brain, but it's in the brain. People have particular characteristic handwriting.
As my understanding with regard to that issue is that over a long morning or afternoon, someone has to write enough times, and then an expert can be brought in to determine if there's an attempt to try and fake it or
right.
If this
understand
whatever
what
the
it's
situation
for.
May be.
Yeah, that's what it's for, but what has to happen in order for that to happen, which is allowed, as I understand it, under the Fifth Amendment, is the person has to sit in a room and write, use their handwriting.
To write that which is recorded for them to turn around and
right.
Put
they're
back
not coming
in.
Up
same
with original
voice
prose. But they're not coming up with original prose, but they are actually writing. That's a mental process.
I would say that writing is a physical. I know Amicus is fully familiar with these issues. To me, writing develops as a physical manifestation, and in those cases, they're looking to link up the forensic evidence with some proof of physicality as it relates to your tendencies.
You're not giving up a fact, which is different. When you're giving up a code, you're giving up something that you uniquely possess as opposed to replicating that. I want to ask you a
run
question.
With that one also. That would be run with that one also, like you suggested last time.
No, what if they break the code? You said this that the Fifth Amendment protects this private enclave where every person may lead a private life. If the state is able to break the code on its own without any help from the defendant, is there a Fifth Amendment violation there?
No, there may be fourth. From my view of it, although we're not dealing with that, there may be, I think in New Jersey under the expanded law, there may be Fifth Amendment rights with regard to the private enclave.
That's what I'm asking you.
I believe there might be as it relates to that. But what I've suggested is that The remedy here is not for us to eviscerate the Fifth Amendment in this action. It's for Congress, as Justice Alito said in the O'Reilly case. Congress has got to speak to this because you're leaving us out here. And we could, as Americans, the state in the Commonwealth v. Davis case said, gee, this is really bad for the rest of us because there may be draconian privacy.
I'm trying to understand your conception of our law. If the state breaks the code on its own, in your opinion, is there a violation of our right against self-incrimination as explicated in Guarino?
I believe that the private enclave in Guarino would absolutely challenge that action as
but
it relates to.
They've already got the search warrant. They already are entitled to enter the private enclave, just like they get the search warrant for the safe deposit box and it's got a key. Or they get the search warrant for the safe, it's got a combo, but now their safe cracker cracks the combo, opens it up. They've got the right to the enclave. The question is whether they have the right to the combination from the defendant. How is that anything more than a Fourth Amendment issue? And that's already resolved here.
First of all, Your Honor, in terms of it having been resolved, the Fourth Amendment issue, an ex parte warrant was issued. It rendered,
search warrant.
A search warrant was
pursuant to an affidavit, like every other search
correct.
Warrant in New Jersey.
It rendered it resulted in no evidence being discovered.
Because they never entered the enclave.
Correct. And so it was never challenged.
Just like
because
if
there
they
was
don't enter the
challenge
house. If they don't enter the house, in other words, Justice Albin's question is asking you, like the search warrant for the home, they have to open the door. They open the door. The search warrant for the safe. They can't say, go get me the key, but they could pick the lock. How is that any different?
I would say the following. The cell phones are becoming an extension of our memory, our recollection, and there's a private enclave issue with regard to that. I know I'm not
enclave,
addressing that issue.
But they don't ever get the combo. They don't ever get anything. They just are able to open it, just like they open the safe, just like they open the door. They're able to open it. Somebody comes up with the system, puts a magnet next to it, yells a word at it. I don't know, whatever. It pops open. How are they not entitled to the enclave? They already got the search warrant.
In that scenario, we wouldn't be making these arguments here as
tell
it relates to that. We'd have a Fourth Amendment argument, and I believe there would be, in New Jersey at least, a Fifth Amendment private enclave argument.
Consider that, because I'm puzzled by this. Consider that in light of the wiretap statute. You go to a judge, you get an order, make the required showing to be able to listen in on conversations. Can't listen in on privileged conversations. Are you suggesting that you also can't listen in on certain conversations based on the Fifth Amendment, New Jersey's version?
Well, I think if you're conversing with somebody else, you're surrendering certain privacy interests. If you're conversing with somebody else.
So here we're talking about text messages,
well,
back and forth. How is that different?
The difference is this, Your Honor. They want to obtain those through a compelled Fifth Amendment operation.
Granted, but Justice, the question you were wrestling with is there a Fifth Amendment protection that applies if they're not seeking the passcode from you? And I don't see how you get there.
Your Honor, I would come forward to Your Honor and make some argument at that juncture as it relates to if we get codification again from Guarino about private enclave with regard to this ubiquitous use of cell phones and so on. That stands out there as a concern. It's not an issue in this case, but it stands out there as a concern. The Fourth Amendment, you get to contest after some finding or some evidence is obtained as a result of a search warrant. You get to contest the validity of the search warrant and all of those issues in some subsequent due process proceeding. But here, we don't have that because that never occurred. And so then the motion came down after discovery, after motions to dismiss, just before trial was to start. The motion came down to compel the passcode. And so again, I recognize the Fourth Amendment search and seizure is a different amendment. It protects different interests. And and there are plenty of instances where they're able to break into the code as it relates to that. I know that these cell phones are being looked at differently than a lot of other technology only because of the things that they possess.
Yeah, but they can't get anything that the search warrant says they can get. Just like they go into a house, they're looking for certain specific things. They can't take anything and everything, you know, mom's DVDs, dad's, if they're totally unrelated. they can't, they're entitled to look and see, did that text message go to this phone, because we have the number, we have this number, we know where it came from, we know where it went, we know when it was sent, we can look for that, limited to that. The other privacy issues, they're separate. We're not, they're not saying we got to get everything, we just are entitled to this confirmation.
If I remember the record correctly, Justice, the state's initial two applications sought entry into the cell phone, and there weren't a lot of limiting factors with regard to that. At oral argument,
the basis was to confirm the text and other communications.
That was,
they had date, time, and place for all of them.
This is what developed in the oral argument at the.
So let's say it's limited to that. Okay. You don't have a problem with that?
Do I have a problem with them entering a cell phone if they're able to access it?
Only to getting the limited information they've said they're entitled to.
Through the Fourth Amendment?
Yes.
Sir, I'm not prepared to say, I confess to not being prepared to have.
Well, suppose the issue comes down and says, listen, guys and ladies, if you get, if you can open it, just like if you can open the, knock down the door, open, pick the lock, whatever, if you can open it, you can have what the search warrant says you're entitled to.
That case may or may not come. In fact,
no, maybe here right now.
The Manning case last week.
I'm just saying. Hold on. It may be here right now. What do you say?
Right now on this case?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. I don't believe it's here right now because the proposition you're making, sir, is that they were able to access it and they weren't.
I think I understand your hesitance because the Boyd case, which Guarino reaffirmed, was dealing with something similar to a personal diary, and the question was, even under the Fifth Amendment, do you have a right, does the government have a right to force someone to turn over a personal diary to look into it? And I think there were Fourth Amendment implications there as well. Am I mistaken?
That's my belief, is that the cell phones are different than maybe a warrant to search a car or something along those lines. They have developed into the diary, into the medical records, into
right. But the trial court here was obviously aware of the potential ramifications of just open access to a cell phone.
The trial court.
The trial court. Right. The trial court had a very limited, nuanced order that was talked about an in-camera review initially. Yeah. Seemed to be geared toward keeping any disclosure within the confines of the search warrant. Would you agree with me?
I believe that when we were done briefing and arguing the trial court level 3 years ago almost, we kept pushing and pushing. I read that transcript, kept pushing and pushing as to the fact that, and the state said, well, there's a lot of apps that we may want to look at. We'll see when we get in there. The state says those types of things. We pointed that out. Now, Judge Batista, I believe, indicated, no, my order says he'll come into chambers. We'll verify the code is not.
We're reviewing a judgment here, and it has the parameters that it has. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're almost at the half hour, believe it or not. So what I want to do is give you a chance to move on to foregone conclusion. And with so many able lawyers here today, I'm going to have to keep close to the time that's allotted.
Understood.
Please.
The third point I was making to the court was that I do not believe that the record supports the foregone conclusion either under the older, more thorough doctrine that was created by the courts in the 60s, or the very, as I would describe it, modified, relaxed version. The reason for that is, first of all, there's a concession by the state at the end of their brief that, well, we what's the standard going to be? Reasonable particularity. The Massachusetts case used proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There was a different case that used clear and convincing evidence. It's in our brief. But at this juncture, we're sitting here under the probable cause standard. That's all that we have because the entire support for the application was the issuance of the search warrant. With that said, the facts on this case are, I would argue, the state even suggests, with regard to knowledge of the phone and the code, the state suggests that they don't have, they say at one point, page 30 of their brief, the state must prove independently not only that the defendant has possession and control over the device, but that he had possession and control over the device at the time of any incriminating text was sent on the phone. They've come before the court and said, with regard to this relaxed standard, it'll be self-executing. Authenticity will be self-executing when he puts in a code and it opens. They need all of that, even by the appellate division's decision here. They need all that with regard to their a foregone conclusion that it's his phone, he must know the codes. They need to be able to prove that. They can't even prove that, and they concede that in their brief. The bigger foregone conclusion analysis of specified knowledge with regard to what's in there, this, you know, they take lots and lots of shots at Mr. Andrews in this matter, but there's so very little that in any way engages with the phone. In fact, Mr. Lowry, the alleged co-conspirator, says, we didn't use the phone for that stuff. He didn't say stuff, but that's what he said. And so now, what they've done is they've built this the series of allegations. We'll look at this and look at that. Lowry doesn't even know my client's name. He doesn't even know my client's name. And they say again and again, the phone is not used for that purpose. It was used for work.
What do we make of the fact that the state has this call log of 187 calls?
Okay, and so people contact each other all the time, and then their own witness says, we didn't use the phone for any criminal endeavors, in so many words. So now you're getting to, well, there's supposition. It's a foregone assumption that they're asking the court to make here, not a foregone conclusion. You know, in terms of 187 calls, we don't know the nature of the relationship. Might not be what Lowry suggests, but they need something to say. And Lowry comes out and says, we did not use the phone for that wank.
Correct me if I'm remembering this incorrectly. Doesn't he also say I sent them a license plate in connection with?
He said that there are two quote-unquote offending texts. A license plate that he sent that gets no response is the one that Your Honor is referring to. There was and there's no response to it. And there's no running of the license plate by Andrews through his police abilities to run a plate. Magically, we then find out that he must know that that is, he must know, must have communicated that that is a government law enforcement license plate. That is a massive leap. And I would just suggest the Davis case out of Pennsylvania. That defendant opened up the one device, spoke out of turn on numerous occasions about different information he had and how it would hurt him to open the device and so on. Here, my client appeared at his employer, surrendered his phones, we asked for them back, he took five, and that was it. And so now you have this hodgepodge without a hearing, without any kind of evidentiary showing as it relates to this foregone conclusion, which is why I think it was watered down and brought to, well, it's his phone, so he must know it. And that becomes, I don't think they've satisfied it even under that relaxed standard. I don't believe they've satisfied the foregone conclusion as espoused by the appellate division.
I have to address contempt.
Very quickly. I went back and looked at what a court can hold someone in contempt for. Failure to appear, failure to go to a proceeding, being disruptive in court. All knowable and provable things. Here, 5 years after the fact, my client, if we're not successful, will be compelled to show up and start speaking. Now, it's the cruel trilemma. It's he speaks and incriminates himself. He speaks, or he doesn't speak and goes to jail, or he speaks and says, you know, try this, try that. If those attempts are not successful, is he in contempt? The contempt has to be, the violation has to be knowing and purposeful. How does the trial court then begin to dig down further into his brain, further into the issues before us here in terms of, is his memory bad? What, you know, why don't you remember? Let's talk about other codes.
Well, let's face it. If this court were to hold that he has no Fifth Amendment privilege or no common law privilege and that he has to disclose his passcode, I think a court could probably draw a very strong inference going all the way to guilt that he knows the passcode to his phone if he doesn't turn it over. No? You don't think
I don't
so?
Believe so, sir, because these passcodes are changeable. I mean, if I change my passcode to every one of my accounts every couple months because I haven't been on in a couple months and I forget what I put in there. This stuff happens. The phone's been out of his possession for 5 years. I don't believe you can make the leap that he must remember the code.
We can remember the last passcode. I mean, it may be that there's a technical, something has happened to the phone or whatever, but I think what this entire case is about is the passcode he was using when he turned over the phone.
Correct. And just so we're clear, he turned over the phone in the summer of 2015. It did not become an issue again in this case until January or February 2017. So for all that time, he doesn't use the phone, have any muscle memory, or have recollection. I have no idea if my client remembers that password.
Why are we going to the willfulness of disobeying a court order, and our argument should focus on whether a court order is appropriate?
I agree. I'm only suggesting that it's another avenue to look at and say, how do we, because at some point this has the impact of causing further conditions down the road that need to be cured or dealt with.
You're not representing to us that your client doesn't know his code.
I have not spoken to my client about whether what knowledge he has or doesn't have about his code.
Okay.
In any way, shape, or form, because I don't want to become in possession of something and then be responsible for producing it. I have no idea.
The only reason why I ask that, because if he didn't know his code, then I don't know why we're all assembled here today.
We would be here anyway.
We're assembled here today because I frankly was offended when I saw the initial application come down as truly an affront. And I'm like, I don't know if he knows it or not. I have no idea. I don't know what's on there. And I never got into that because I'm saying, 3 years, I was ready to try a case back in 2017, 3 years later, and before your honors, saying that these are major constitutional implications here that have to be addressed.
I just want to tell Amiki it's not necessary for you to tell us whether you're offended and why you're here. We accept that you're all here today.
Since we're here with 11
There's a presumption of being offended.
Counsel, if it was so clear, we wouldn't be here with 11 Amiki, so I don't understand why you were offended.
I don't mean to be.
That's the word you used.
Okay, I did, and I don't mean to be dismissive about that. But the reality of it is that the state points out that there's never been a real test of this issue with regard to the key to the lockbox versus the combination to the code, and the reason for that I think is because it strikes me as clear. Then I get into this case, and I'm saying they want to compel. They file an application. And I am animated, they file an application to get my client to do something that no one else has ever had to do. And here I am 3 years later because there's a chance he may have to do it.
We're here because it's a very important issue.
Yes, I concur.
And so we're ready to focus on the argument. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would only like to speak to the issue. I take great pride in what I do in terms of the Constitution and protecting it and fighting for it. And
what you do, but that does call for being offended when the other side argues something else.
Take my apology. It's not offended as in that's an outrageous insult. I'm offended that the Fifth Amendment is being attacked in that way.
We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good. Ms. Jarrett.
Preliminarily, given the number of amici, I know, Chief Justice, you mentioned the letter that we provided to you about
Fifth
our
Amendment.
Assigned Fifth Amendment, yes. Okay, I'm just going to jump straight to it. the Fifth Amendment protects against compelling a suspect to reveal the contents of his own mind that will be used to further his prosecution. This is precisely what the state wishes to do in this case. There are three prongs to determine whether government conduct is prohibited by the Fifth Amendment. The first is there must be compulsion. The second is the information sought must be incriminating. And the third is that the communication must be testimonial. Here there's no question that a court order satisfies the compulsion requirement. And the passcode is plainly incriminating as it, quote, furnishes a link in the chain of evidence that will be used to further his prosecution. The question before the court is whether this is testimonial, which is defined as whether the communication requires the suspect to use the contents of his own mind to relay an implied or express assertion of fact or belief. A more easily applied test is whether or not the communication implicates the cruel trilemma of self-accusation, perjury, or contempt. The cruel trilemma, which was an inquisitorial method deplored by the founders, was the very evil that the Fifth Amendment sought to forbid and is precisely what occurs when a suspect is ordered to provide the passcode to his phone. That person faces a choice of either one, revealing the passcode, which will lead to incriminating information, two, lying by providing potentially an incorrect passcode or saying they don't know what the passcode is, and subjecting himself to perjury, and three, remaining silent and being held in contempt. Because the person is placed in this cruel trilemma, the compelled disclosure of a passcode falls squarely within the purview of communications protected by the Fifth Amendment. I would like to make just a couple of points on the Fifth Amendment, as perhaps your honors won't even be relying on the Fifth Amendment in this case going forward.
The first is that the cases cited by the government are perfect examples of non-testimonial conduct because none of them require the suspect to reveal the contents of his mind. So, for example, forcing a suspect to put on a blouse. That suspect is not revealing anything within the contents of their mind. Another example is, again, the fingerprint. The contents of that suspect's mind, again, are not being disclosed in any way. Even in the cases where the defendant needs to use his brain, for example, to speak or to write something, that is different than revealing the contents of one's mind. Also, the content of those communications, because of course writing is a communication, speaking is a communication, but the truth or the falsity of the content of those communications has no bearing on what is being compelled. So, for example, I could be forced to give a handwriting sample, and I could write, my name is Bob, I am a monster, and that would be untrue, but the truth or the falsity of it does not matter. But here, with the passcode, the truth or the falsity of the passcode does matter.
Can I ask a question? Is there a substantive difference? Assuming for a minute they haven't gotten on the cell phone and disallowed facial recognition. I don't even know how to do that, but assuming you can. is there a substantive difference between the passcode and the facial recognition or the thumbprint?
Yeah, so again, this isn't briefed. I think the technology is potentially more complicated than we think it is than just putting...
All technology is more complicated yeah. than I think it is.
And I think Epic probably is a better person to talk about that than I am. However, assuming that it isn't more complicated than we think, I do think that there can be a distinction made because the fingerprint or the facial recognition does not reveal the contents.
It's closer to a fingerprint type.
But it does.
The fingerprint.
Oh, I'm sorry. We were going to say content of.
Of the mind.
True. Substantively, though, how are they different? They both give you access to this thing.
Right.
How are they in any way different?
So it's the question of the focus is on what the suspect needs to do in order to relay that information. Does the suspect need to delve into their brain to reveal its contents, its information that the state does not know? And it sounds abstract.
The face is in the public domain, and the fingerprint is in the public domain, but the thoughts conveyed through the passcode are not, correct?
That's correct. That's precisely it. And
Justice Solomon's phone says it's never met him.
It won't open.
Oh.
Unless my wife has to call me for
yeah,
me to get
you need this. Grandkids.
Yeah. So. No. not yet.
Yeah. Another example. I got thrown off a little bit, but in terms of the. What Justice Levecki was talking about, the innermost thoughts of someone, protecting those thoughts. Mm-hmm. The Fifth Amendment is also about individual autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the state invading the mind of someone and their contents, while the Fourth Amendment is about the state invading your personal space. The Fifth Amendment is about the state invading your mind. Mm-hmm. And so, again, we're talking about like big abstract concepts here, but that really is the basis of what the founders were talking
about. How does that relate to your challenge to the use of contempt to be able to enforce an order if this court were to agree such an order should be imposed?
Well, I don't think the court should be compelling this because I think that it's protected by the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
A judicial order is compulsion.
Right.
And so I don't think there should be an order, but I think if there's an order and someone disobeys a valid order, then
are we going to be jailing people for refusing to enter passcodes into phones?
It has happened nationally. It's not unheard of. So potentially.
But in your brief, you point out that there are other devices or techniques available to the state to avoid this problem that we're discussing today.
Yes.
Can you address those?
Sure. And again, I'm not an expert in technology. However, if you do a quick Google search, you can certainly find companies that claim to be able to open these phones.
Yesterday's New York Times.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly.
Mm-hmm.
This phone was from 2015. The technology of this phone is from 2015. We're now 5 years advanced from there. you know, I don't.
Should it make a difference for your argument?
No. Should not. Law enforcement need is not an exception to the Constitution, as we've found over and over again.
So let's dwell on that for just a second. If you prevail, are we effectively telegraphing to those who would engage in crime, get this kind of an iPhone, get this kind of a cell phone, because it will be a safe haven when the police come looking for the evidence? And does that have any place in the analysis?
I don't think it has any place in the analysis. I mean, it would be, before iPhones, right, it would be like telling a suspect, don't write anything down. You know, don't have a map in your drawer with a circle of where the bodies are hidden, you know? I mean, it's the same thing. It's just a new iteration of it.
No, but the fact is that the communications have occurred. That's a little bit different from saying don't talk. The communications exist. They would be potentially evidentiary if they were available to the state. Mm-hmm. They may be so relevant they're right at the heart of the case. So there are existing, potentially, maybe not. I have no idea what, if anything, is on these phones. But there is potentially very important evidence in the phones.
Sure.
So it's a little different from saying, to say, get this iPhone and there's no problem because it can't be hacked. It's a little different from saying, don't write this down.
The importance of the information, I think, doesn't come into play with the Fifth Amendment. When we have, for example, let's say we have a suspect and we are 100% sure they know something very, very important, even to public safety. And there is no way we can find out what that suspect knows without them telling us that thing. I'm talking something major, right? Like a bomb, where the bodies are, where a gun is, where something like that. We still cannot, you know, twist that person's arm to get them to speak and to tell us where those things are. So I don't think the importance of the information is
I'm not saying that the importance of the information rules the day. What I'm saying is that it's different from saying don't write this down, don't circle the map, because there is potential evidence that is perhaps at issue here.
May I follow up? It's different in this way. Don't write it down because the police may come and find it.
Right.
As opposed to use this particular cell phone because the police will never be able to access it. That's a different issue. So we're dealing with the latter. And the question is, can that in any way affect the constitutional question in front of the court?
I don't believe it can. I don't believe it can because, again, the Fifth Amendment is about protecting the innermost thoughts of your mind. And whether those thoughts are trivial, are small, or very big, they're still...
It's no different than if you were to compel someone to give the GPS coordinates of where the body would be found.
Exactly.
You wouldn't be able to compel that, I don't think.
No.
Or other privileged information that we know might be helpful in a criminal trial, but nevertheless is shielded for policy reasons.
Sure.
Do you concede that if the state can crack the code on its own, it's entitled to the information even under our own common law privilege?
I do, because there's no compulsion. Because there's no compulsion element. There's no state compulsion involved.
How about a private diary?
As long as
which is produced under no compulsion.
Let's say they find the diary, right, in the house,
yeah,
without any compulsion, then there's no Fifth Amendment
no problem.
Issue.
Okay.
Yeah.
Under the Fifth or under our
I'm sorry, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Just two brief points. The first is the vast majority of cases have, including the appellate division, found that this is a testimonial act. They just then applied the foregone conclusion doctrine, which my colleague will be discussing next. And lastly, the state's argument that it may never actually learn the passcode and therefore there is no problem here is misplaced. The testimonial prong, as I've talked about, focuses on what the suspect, his experience in providing that information, first of all. The fact that the state might not learn the actual passcode but then gets the fruits of that passcode still makes the passcode or the revealing of the passcode in secret testimonial and incriminating. There are several cases which have been cited in the briefs talking about how incriminating doesn't just, whether or not something is incriminating isn't about whether that particular information itself is incriminating, but also whether it will lead to incriminating information.
So how do you address Doe 2? Because it clearly led, had the potential to lead to incriminating information.
Yes. So in Doe 2, they said it was incriminating, and they said it was compelled, but they said it was not testimonial. And the reason they said that is because basically how I read Doe 2 is the, first of all, the consent form that was written had extremely explicit language, very particular language, that allowed the person to sign the form and not admit anything that they had a link to these accounts, that they had any accounts to begin with, that these were authentic accounts. So they weren't admitting anything in the signature. It would be essentially, basically, the government needed to access these accounts and they needed a signature to do it. The signature essentially was the way to get into account the way a passcode is. The difference being is that in Doe 2, they knew that the signature was the way to get into account. Here, they don't know what the way to get into the phone is.
They know it's a passcode.
Right.
They know in Doe 2 it was a signature.
Right, exactly. So all they needed to do was the mechanical act of the signature.
But there's no dispute here. Tell me if I'm wrong, that these were cell phones that this individual used.
Oh,
I had control over.
I actually don't think that's in the record, necessarily.
Okay.
Do you believe that our common law privilege and evidence rule provides greater protection?
Of course, yes.
Do you think that we should be answering the Fifth Amendment question and our common law, or the common law of the Fifth Amendment? Do you have any opinion on how you think this court should proceed?
I think your honors should rely on our state law privilege if possible.
Thank you, Ms. Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, and may it please the court. As we indicated, I'd like to focus my time on why, as the Pennsylvania Supreme Court recently held, the so-called foregone conclusion exception to the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination should never apply in cases like this one, where the state seeks to compel the defendant to disclose his passcode or enter it to unlock his phone, and I'll offer three reasons for that. First, the trial court's order should be viewed as compelling pure testimony simply because, as Ms. Jarrett said, it relies on the contents of the defendant's mind. The foregone conclusion exception can no more compel that sort of testimony than it could to force a suspect to answer questions orally or in writing, nod, or other nonverbal communication. Second, complying with the court's order cannot be fairly described as the sort of act of production to which the foregone conclusion exception can apply under certain circumstances. Here, the state already has the phones, so there's nothing for the defendant to produce. Instead, he's being asked to help the state in understanding or accessing that evidence, again, using the contents of his mind. And third, even if it could be viewed as an act of production, applying the foregone conclusion exception in these circumstances would be a vast and unwarranted expansion of what is actually a very narrow legal doctrine announced and applied by the U.S. Supreme Court in a single case, Fisher. And in Fisher, that exception allowed the compelled production of just pre-existing tax records prepared by a third-party CPA. And of the lower courts that have recognized have even recognized this exception, the vast majority apply it to very similar circumstances, allowing the production of business or financial records, not the sort of open-ended and intimate communications typically found on a smartphone or a computer.
Let's look at the court's order here. The court's order here is not about open-ended and intimate communications. It's about specific types of communications that appear to be within the parameters of relevancy in this prosecution.
Well, it did purport to limit, as I understand it, to certain aspects of the phone, certain applications. I think that what could be found in those applications is still quite intimate. So calling records.
If we look at Fisher and we say, okay, those are pre-existing records. They are records that were, as I understand the case, directly relevant to the prosecution of this individual. Am I right about that in Fisher?
I believe that's correct.
Okay. So if you assume here that the trial court's order would not include all of the hundreds or thousands of other things that might be found on a cell phone, but deal with texts and telephone communications, only those with respect to one individual who's obviously at the core of this case. Why is that conceptually different from Fisher?
Well, as I said, Fisher applied to these tax records, and of the courts that have actually applied to lower courts, and there's a single U.S. Supreme Court case, of the lower courts that have applied it, they've all looked at business or financial records. And on the contrary, other times when it's been raised for the compelled production of other kinds of physical evidence, guns, drugs, you know, sort of more concrete evidence, courts have refused to apply it.
Yeah, but that's a distinction. But in those prosecutions, presumably, business records were the core of the prosecution, and the prosecutors want to get their hands on the business records in order to prosecute the person for whatever the federal offense was.
And
here, what I understand this prosecution to be about is the state is trying to prosecute this individual based largely on communications with another individual. So where is the analytical distinction between the documents that they wanted to use in those cases and the texts or phone records that they want to use in this case?
So I'd offer a couple of distinctions.
And they're both pre-existing, right?
That's correct. And but so, again, are the sorts of physical evidence that are not allowed under
okay.
the
court. Okay, guns, drugs, a little different. What I'd like to hear is what the distinction is between.
There's a couple of distinctions, Your Honor. First, business records, business and financial records, have been subject to inspection in a way that all other kinds of records have not, and we offer some case law in our briefs for that distinction. I also think that this idea that just because it's relevant in his prosecution means that it could be turned over has no limit. So, but you're saying guns and drugs are different. But why are they different? What would stop the state from compelling a suspect to lead them to the location of a gun that they couldn't find, as in the case that we've cited in our brief, or to a buried body or the GPS?
But that's not this case. And you said correctly that business and financial records are routinely open for inspection, but so are phone records, so are text messages. What's the distinction you're drawing here?
Those records are open for inspection from other third parties. You can go to the telecom, get a warrant or other legal process to get them, just like you can get the contents of very personal diaries or, in fact, seize a phone. If you find it, you can get a search warrant
to
seize it.
Third-party bank has the records. They went to the third party. Third-party communications provider has the records. They go to the third party.
Certainly, Your Honor, and I think that's my point, is that the state is not limited in what it can do. It can go to these third parties. It's just that going through the defendant and using the contents of his mind is what's off limits under the Fifth Amendment.
But in Fisher, he was compelled to essentially hand over the code, right?
And my argument here is that that's a single case, a real outlier for a single narrow set of documents, and that really what we're talking about here expands that exception.
In Fisher, the court found that the papers belonged to the accountant, were prepared by him. It was very narrow. And what I want to ask you is whether Hubbell narrowed this concept of foregone conclusion, because it didn't buy the government's argument, even though it had subpoenaed numerous documents.
That's right. I mean, so as I mentioned, it's only ever been applied in Fisher, and then the government has attempted to raise it in a couple of other cases, the Doe 2 case and in Hubbell, and rejected in both of those cases because the government couldn't specify and couldn't...
With a reasonable probability. As I understand, in Hubbell, there was a subpoena for a lot of documents, but the government couldn't say with reasonable probability what the documents were, and applying that, let's apply that concept here. Can the state say with reasonable probability what precisely those texts are going to say?
My understanding is they can't based on the record, and that the sort of categorical requests in Hubbell and in Doe 1, were off limits to the foregone conclusion exception for that very reason.
But they can say what one text is going to say, and they can at least say calls or texts from this one particular phone number. They know that with some specificity, including dates, time, and place, because they have the other phone from which the texts, frankly, they know from the other phone what was said in those texts, when it was said, where it went, what phone. In other words, they know all the specificity they didn't have in Hubbell. They know exactly what they're looking for, date, time, place, and number.
Well, Well, respectfully, Your Honor, the court's order doesn't contain that specificity. It doesn't say to the defendant, turn over these particular records or, you know, this particular record, assuming,
it's,
of course,
it's a search warrant that says, including but not limited to.
The search warrant?
Yeah, the search warrant says that.
But it does not.
I'm making a point.
Yes.
The search warrant says including but not limited to, so theoretically they could get more. But if the search warrant said limited to phone calls from this number at these times and texts from this number saying this.
As I understand Hubbell, the burden on the state here is to establish that any and all testimonial significance of complying with the order can be shown to a foregone conclusion. That right. That wasn't shown in Hubbell because it was sort of a categorical.
I understand that. Yep. I'm talking about this. They have the specificity here that they didn't have in Hubbell.
The state would have to establish any testimonial significance of him entering his passcode and supplying this evidence to them could be established through a foregone conclusion exception, assuming that the foregone conclusion exception applies at
Understood.
All. And so that requires showing that it was in his possession and control, that it was authentic, and that it was existing at the time. I don't see how the state can establish that in a case like this.
Meaning the cell phone.
The cell phone or the data?
The contents as well, because it's, as Ms. Jarrett said, a link in the chain.
So the state comes in and says these were two cell phones that he turned over to us. They were, gets the subscriber information, gets somebody from the subscriber to testify about who owned them, and does all the usual things they do with phone records. Why is that such a difficult burden?
So nevertheless, he would be relying on the contents of his mind to unlock and supply the contents of the phone to the state, and that would have testimonial significance. It would show that the files on the phone were existing at the time, that they were under his possession control, that they were authentic, that he had created them. There's all this circumstantial evidence that would be delivered to the state based on his testimonial act. And I think that that is what the state has to wrestle with in saying that the foregone conclusion exception applies. We just don't have case law where
I don't understand that respectfully. The timing, if texts have a particular time and date, mm-hmm. and he turns the phone over the next day, why is it such a burden on the state to prove that those texts existed on the phone when he had it? It seems to me that's the least of their concerns in prosecuting this case.
He's still playing a role in delivering that evidence and therefore supplying the inference that he played, you know, that he did send the text at the time that he did. And that testimonial significance that he's being called on to rely on the contents of his mind to supply is what's forbidden under the Fifth Amendment.
He turned over the physical items. He turned over the cell phones. What you're saying is he is not required now to give them what's in his head, what's in his mind, whatever facts are in his mind.
Correct. There's just no case law that compels defendants to play this role in their own investigation.
Hubbell suggests, if you use that its metaphor, that the defendant doesn't have to give the combination to the wall safe.
Correct.
That's in Hubbell.
Correct.
Which narrows the foregone conclusion doctrine.
As I said, I think it's an extremely narrow doctrine that has been applied in this one case for, you know, this question of surrender. And that's not what we have here. We don't have a question of surrender. We have the question of the defendant supplying this testimonial significance and giving the state very valuable link in the chain evidence.
And we've never adopted the foregone conclusion.
Correct.
I think we have your position. Is there anything you want to add?
I wanted to make one comment about your question, the discussion about putting evidence off limits from the state if you rule in favor of the defendant. I don't think that's true as a factual matter, and I certainly agree with Ms. Jarrett's point that it doesn't play a role in the legal analysis. There's a lot of other avenues at the disposal of the state in a case like this. They can get incriminating statements from co-conspirator, from the defendant himself. They can go to the telecommunications companies and get records of the communications to third-party application providers, you know, Google for stored Gmail content of things that might be on the phone. There are these.
Could you just restate what you just said?
I'm saying there's a number of avenues for getting evidence.
No, just about the Gmail content.
So, for instance, there might be messages through third-party app providers from Google's and the Facebook messengers of the world, and that evidence might be well stored with the providers themselves. They show a warrant.
They can issue a warrant finding everywhere he went with his cell phone and whether or not he was in Lowry's presence.
Correct.
They can do all that.
Correct. So geolocation warrants, stored content warrants, that sort of thing. Apple very frequently stores backups of the contents of the phone, and those are accessible with a warrant as well in many cases. And as Ms. Jarrett's brief mentions, there are these third-party providers that offer unlocking services, and you very frequently see that when a company like Apple introduces new technology, a new operating system, there might be a period in which they're not offering that service, and then a vulnerability is discovered, and they are able to unlock the phone on their own. So these are other avenues available to the state, even if it, you know, can't compel the suspect to play the role of delivering this evidence on his own.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court. My name is Christopher Keating, and I'm here with the New Jersey State Bar Association. I'll be focusing on state law issues. The State Bar spent a good amount of time reviewing this issue and arrived at the following conclusion. New Jersey state law protects criminal defendants from being compelled to reveal their cell phone passcodes. Two quick points I want to touch upon, and I'll do my best to not repeat points already made. First, compelling a defendant to provide a passcode violates the privilege against self-incrimination under New Jersey common law. And second, the government cannot obtain a secure right of possession to a criminal defendant's thoughts. To my first point, here the very nature of a passcode and the contents of a phone must fall within the sphere of privacy discussed in Guarino, protected by New Jersey's broad common law privilege against self-incrimination. A passcode's primary, if not only, purpose is privacy. If the allegations as alleged by the state are true, providing the passcode will force the defendant to solve this passcode puzzle, right? It's a combination that needs to be deciphered, solve that puzzle for law enforcement, and walk law enforcement directly into the private realm that is the cell phone of the defendant in that case, ultimately, if the allegations are true, incriminating him. Under a state statute, something incriminates if it yields evidence of a crime, any evidence at all, as Justice Solomon had stated earlier, if I characterize that correctly. In the case of In re Adonisio, stands for the broad proposition that the privilege protects any individual from coercion to incriminating him or herself. Now, the appellate court in Adonisio was distinguished by the appellate court below, I should say, in that the appellate court below reasoned that the subpoena required a defendant to make extensive use of the contents of his mind in order to comply. That's not a workable standard. There's no extensive use doctrine, it's use. Use of one's mind should be where the law is drawn with regard to the common law privilege against self-incrimination. Otherwise, extensive use, undefined, unworkable, would create more questions than it provides answers. Rejecting the extensive use standard would be consistent with the reasoning in Kelsey, State v. Kelsey, an appellate court decision in New Jersey that held that a defendant cannot be forced to turn over instrumentalities of a crime. Similar to here, with the flashlight in that case, the phone is the instrument of the crime here, the instrumentality of the crime. Although the government already has the phone, practically speaking, it doesn't, or we wouldn't be here today. If they were able to use to get into the phone with the search warrant and get that data to hack the phone, we wouldn't be here. So providing the passcode is providing the instrumentality of the crime, the communications as part of a conspiracy, official misconduct, whatever else there might be on the table. The passcode and the phone must be looked at as part and parcel, one and the same, because the passcode provides incriminating evidence, and that's all covered by the common law privilege against self-incrimination. To the second point, this court should reject the appellate court's notion that a search warrant can give the government superior right of possession over thoughts. There's no precedent for such a holding, and the boundaries and that legal theory are unclear and concerning. It's not clear whether the government can contain, what is the government allowed to get superior right over? Is it the brain itself? Is it thought processes? Is it brain cells? And where do we draw the line? If the government can prove that a defendant was involved in a conspiracy, that a crime had been committed and that there were co-conspirators and the defendant knew it was a co-conspirators, can the government gain the right of possession over more facts regarding maybe the names of those co-conspirators? It's not clear, and I think that would also create more questions than provide answers. It appears that the progeny of case law would further diminish the long-established broad common law privilege against self-incrimination. And for these reasons, the State Bar Association requests that the court reject the application of the foregone conclusion entirely, disregard everything we've been discussing for the past hour, and rule in this case on common law grounds. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does anyone need a break? Ms. Iorio.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The U.S. Supreme Court established in Raleigh v. California and Carpenter v. United States that cell phones are quantitatively and qualitatively unique sources of evidence that require heightened constitutional protections, and two, that therefore limited exceptions to constitutional rights should not be mechanically extended to cell phones. Yet, the lower court's rule in this case is not just an extension, but a significant expansion of the foregone conclusion exception that leaves individuals at the mercy of advancing technology, as the Chief Justice wrote in Carpenter. Here, because, one, cell phones contain an astonishing amount of sensitive information that did not exist at the time the foregone conclusion was formulated in Fisher in 1976. Two, because they gather all of this information, including traditional documents, in one place accessible by one passcode or one biometric scan. And three, because pre-digital containers are inept analogies for cell phones, this court should require the government to demonstrate particularized knowledge about the electronic information sought, not just about the passcode. Now, when the foregone conclusion exception was formulated, the U.S. Supreme Court could not have imagined a technology that was capable of capturing the type and the quantity of information about a user that cell phones do now. They really are an extension of the contents of a user's mind, both by the information that they gather and their relation to the user. This is what Riley was concerned about, and it's what you read, what you say, where you go, what you buy, anything that you can think of, there's an app for that. And this amount of information, that's in a cell phone is a concern in the Fifth Amendment context, because concern for privacy is not exclusive to the Fourth Amendment. The First Amendment is concerned about privacy and anonymity. The Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment are also, and Fifth Amendment precedent is very clear that aspects of privacy undergird the reasons for the Fourth Amendment. Even Fisher makes this clear, and the Justices Brennan and Marshall's concurrences in those cases also place significant concern on forcing somebody to give up their private information, their private papers. So in the words of Carpenter, this seismic shift in technology requires reconsidering how the exception is applied to a distinct category of information, because cell phones do not fit neatly under existing precedent. As my colleagues have mentioned, the U.S. Supreme Court has only applied the foregone conclusion exception in situations where business records are involved, they're prepared by somebody else, and the third party was the one that was doing the production. But when we're talking about decrypting a cell phone, we are talking about the user themselves producing the decrypted documents. Another thing that the Fisher Court could not have foreseen is that all of the most personal information about a person would be gathered in one place, or accessible from one place, from one passcode or one biometric scan. And sorry,
thank you.
Was there a question? So This is best illustrated by applying the lower court's rule in this case to the facts of Hubble. And it shows that the progress of science, if that rule is adopted, would erode established constitutional protections. So Hubble involved the production of over 13,000 documents where the government did not have sufficient information about their existence or their possession or their authenticity. And so the foregone conclusion did not apply in that case. But today, all of those documents could be accessible from a cell phone with one scan or one passcode. And so the lower court's rule would require Hubble to hand over all of those documents at issue. If police could establish one thing, whether he knew his passcode or whether he could open up his phone with his face or his thumbprint. But the police would learn the same information. They would learn that these documents existed, that they were authentic, and that the user had possession of them without having to do any more work.
Do you make no distinction between compelling a person to give a passcode, undergoing a mental process, revealing a fact in a person's mind, from requiring the person to give his or her thumbprint to open to gain access to the cell phone?
2 points on that, Your Honor. So we think that one point is that the biometric, you cannot, in most phones today, the biometric passcode can only be used in conjunction with an actual code passcode. If you turn off an iPhone, for instance, when you turn it back on, you need to enter in your actual passcode. You can't use a biometric passcode. And the second point is that this is where technology is going. It's going toward using biometric scans. And for the rule that this court adopts to take into account this technology, the court really does need to adopt a rule that requires the government to have the specific information about the electronic information that they are looking for. And if the court adopts that, then they have the same test for both.
So, but in this case, we have a search warrant.
Yes.
We have a court order that makes clear there would be in-camera review. And although it's not spelled out, I think the implication of that is the court would be looking at the data first to make sure that the data taken by the state is not beyond the parameters of the search warrant and is in a general scan of the cell phone. So why isn't that the concern that you just raised about 13,000 documents and in a click dealt with in this case?
The problem is that the specificity of the warrant and the court order does not play in at all in the Fifth Amendment analysis or the rule that the lower court announced, that only looks to the passcode. It only looks to the information that the government knows about the passcode. The lower court didn't do the analysis, the Fifth Amendment analysis, on the actual electronic information that they were seeking.
I'm not saying that deals with the whole problem, but the specific problem that you just identified, which is the technology's allowing millions of documents to be available on a cell phone. And the breadth of what a production could be if cell phones were generally disclosed. In this particular case, it is a very narrow order. Mm-hmm. It's talking about communications in two forms with one person over a time frame. So why is that aspect of it not dealt with by what happened before the trial court?
So the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment have an interplay, right? And in some circumstances, the Fourth Amendment, to meet the Fourth Amendment requirement of obtaining the information, the government will also meet the Fifth Amendment requirement to provide this specificity as to the existence and control and authenticity of the documents that they seek. However, that might not be the case in all instances. And this court is considering the rule that will govern all cases in New Jersey.
Yeah, I understand, and that's why I was asking, is because the issue you're raising could really have an impact in other cases, but it does seem that the specificity the government's had to put forward in its affidavit in support of the search warrant, the basis for its belief that these will be found, there's probable cause to believe that these documents will be found. There is some specificity in this case.
Correct. And if the lower court had adopted a rule that looked to the specificity in that case and found that it met the Fifth Amendment burden, then that would be fine, but that's not what they did.
Do you accept the distinction between the key to the safe and the combination?
That goes to the inept analogy to pre-digital containers. So here's the issue with that. One is that
Stay with the pre-era.
Pre-era.
You accept the distinction?
No.
So you go beyond case law in that regard?
Well, because the Supreme Court has never actually held that a person can be compelled to unlock, produce the key and unlock the strong box, or to enter in the passcode.
You don't accept the reasoning in the court's opinion.
There's very little reasoning. I think it's a quick mention by Justice Stevens that this could be a distinction that has some weight, and the majority in Doe 2 put a footnote in and said, yeah, we think that there might also be something behind there, but there's very little fleshing out of what that means within the foregone conclusion exception.
Is the use of biometrics akin to the combination or to the key?
Well, I would challenge analogizing the contents of a cell phone at all to the contents of a strong box or a safe, because the contents of a cell phone are dynamic. They change all the time, even when they're not in the possession of the user. Push notifications give new text messages, they give new social contacts, they give new emails unexpected ways. When
you're not answering the chief's question.
I'm sorry.
He's asking whether the analogy is to the key or to the passcode.
Whether the passcode is more like the combination than the key.
Mm-hmm.
Biometrics.
The biometrics. They should be treated the same. So if we are going with the passcode, the combination I would go more on that end of things, but so I also have an issue with the entire analogy.
It sounds as though you're going beyond what we've heard from some other advocates as well.
Yes.
Assuming that the passcode is not necessary, or maybe it is now or isn't now, but won't be next week, that a cell phone is entirely based on facial recognition or some other form of biometrics.
Correct.
Is it your client's or your amicus's position that biometrics should be off limits in this kind of situation?
The law, as we have briefed it, is that that in the case of a biometric passcode, that the rule should look to the information that the government knows about the documents that they seek on the phone, and that is closer to the act of production doctrine that has been articulated in Fisher and in Hubble.
So you think, is it biometrics an act of production?
Yes.
If the showing is made properly.
The act of production is in producing the decrypted contents of the phone.
So what you're saying is the more the government knows, the greater the right they have to compel something from a person's mind. So let's say they were able to give a particular description of what they believed was on the phone, something that met the standard of reasonable particularity. Is it your position, under those circumstances, they would have a right to compel the code?
There is an additional issue, perhaps, with having to divulge the passcode, meaning state it. It's its own testimonial aspect. But in the actual act of production doctrine, that is correct. That is what we say.
That's your position.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
I think we have.
Thank you.
Review. Thank you, Mr. Adams.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices of the Court, may it please the Court. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers to highlight the inflection point that this case represents. Our state's jurisprudence is somewhat lacking in the area of these sophisticated technological concerns. While the Association agrees with everything that our esteemed colleagues has previously said and does not intend to reiterate those questions here today, I'm here to implore the Court to not only adopt the positions that have been heretofore mentioned, but also to specifically articulate that heightened scrutiny is required when fundamental rights intersect with technological issues. And the reason for this step that I would respectfully request and the Association would respectfully request is that in some of our state's jurisprudence this has been lacking. I specifically cite, and the Association cites in its amicus brief, to the State versus Hanna decision of the Appellate Division. While that is settled law, Your Honors, that is dealing with something of a far less sophisticated nature than what is presently before the Court. That involves the authentication requirements of a tweet, a mere publication on the internet of information. I would respectfully submit that there have been, and the Association has recognized, that there have been unintended consequences of attempting to marry a brick and mortar concept like authentication under 901 with a technological issue such as the one before the Court presently, because digital is decidedly different, Your Honors. The impact of HANA has been striking. It has been used to deny defendants discovery because it rests on the notion of traditional concepts of authentication, and defendants are routinely denied such things as metadata associated with technological evidence. The state is held to that the less than exacting standard that full discovery of such things as metadata with a medium of evidence that is easily susceptible to corruption, modification, alteration, and deletion. This is indeed an inflection point that the Court can articulate, because as the Court has grappled with today, this will not be the last time that issues such as this one are addressed.
So what's the standard that you're asking this Court to adopt?
A heightened level of scrutiny when issues that address fundamental rights intersect.
What does that mean?
That means that...
What do you want us to write in an opinion?
Akin to strict scrutiny, Your Honor. Akin to the notions that this Court has typically followed from State versus Strong in 1988, when the Court enunciated that both the strictest scrutiny of the greatest protections against prosecutorial use of compelled testimony.
So what does that mean? I'm trying to apply these broad principles.
Yes, Your Honor.
To the facts of this case. Like, what principle of law would you have us enunciate in this specific case with respect to a passcode?
So when the biometric issue comes before the Court, there needs to be an enhanced showing by the state of why they can't find another reason, another way around getting into that phone.
Well, I'm the one who brought that one up. I think that is not what's before us.
No, it's not, Judge.
So how about, just following up on Justice Albin's question, what is the principle that you would state for the passcode situation we have? What's the showing the state has to make? What guidance would you provide for courts?
First and foremost, that there is a compelling need and no other alternative means exist. I think by the state's own acknowledgement in this case, by virtue of its foregone conclusion doctrine, that argument, there perhaps is.
Let's say there is none. Are you saying if there is no means by which the state can get into the phone, that under those circumstances, it has the right to compel the code from the defendant's mind?
No, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand your position.
My position is the following, Judge. This case is but the first of a sequence of cases that are to come. Just like the United States Supreme Court has started grappling with Riley, Carpenter, and Jones, The next evolution, Andrews 2.0, so to speak, will be the issue of what once, say you can get inside the phone, what are you entitled to look at? this phone that I hope that I use today, this iPhone, is a lot different than this old phone right here. This old phone right here had far less information. In fact, as we cite in our brief, this phone here that I use has more computing power than that launched the Apollo astronauts to the moon. So when we view these constitutional issues, these fundamental rights issues, it's important not to lose sight of the fact that we're not dealing with bricks and mortar concepts anymore.
I don't think you have any concern whatsoever the court thinks this is about bricks and mortar. None. Even though I was until recently using one of those flip phones.
You'd be amazed what I had to do to take
years ago.
This out. Justice.
But
should have called one of us.
But the fact, you know, we do understand that there are potential other cases. But I think what we're looking for from you know, all of the excellent advocates today is what is it that you would have us do to guide courts in a fair way that's consistent with the Constitution and with common law?
Affirmatively enunciate that digital is different.
Okay, once we do that, people are going to say, yeah, we kind of knew that already.
You want us to exercise caution.
Shockingly, Your Honors, courts below are clinging for guidance from bricks and mortars concepts that do not provide a clean analogy. The book concept that Hannah clings to, for example.
So what is the test? I know about brick and mortar. I know about this flip phone you pulled out. I don't know much about the iPhone, but what is the concept that you would like for this court to enunciate in an opinion other than, you know, they're different? Because even I know that.
Well, that when dealing with fundamental rights issues in the digital age, we're no longer going to be looking to a clean analogy. That this is a fresh start. That this is an issue.
And what is the fresh start that you would like this court to write an opinion? What is it that you would like the trial courts to be guided by?
That there is no longer a requirement under our law of this state that we have this idea of clinging to some arcane concept like in Hannah did with the
book. So what is the new concept that you want us to espouse?
An appreciation for the breadth and scope of what is in the digital environment, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.